Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Monday morning. This is the show here on KJZZ 91.5 with Lauren Gilger in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. And we welcome today listeners on KAWC in Yuma, which is carrying the show. So good morning. Hello to Yuma and Parker. Coming up today on the show, why some advocates are worried about the state's social service system as summer power bills will be coming due next month, and why Valley musicians are turning to the kitchen. But we start with Proposition 105 in Phoenix, which voters soundly defeated. It sought to end the expansion of light rail in Phoenix in the August 27th special election. That was largely thanks to neighborhoods where light rail already exists. An analysis of the vote by the Arizona Mirror found the South Phoenix area where the campaign against light rail began supported the effort, but the rest of the city instead stood opposed to Prop 105. Consider downtown Phoenix, where the central light rail hub is located. Less than 13% of voters in that area supported Prop 105. Jim Small is the editor of the Arizona Mirror and joins us now to talk about the Mirror's analysis of who voted in the Phoenix special election. Hey, Jim.
Good morning, Mark.
So it sounds as though for areas of Phoenix where light rail is already established, people there, I guess you could say, are fairly happy with it.
Yeah, I think that was definitely one of our big takeaways from the analysis. I mean, obviously, this was a ballot measure that was defeated very, very broadly. I mean, it was, you know, about a 2-to-1 defeat. So across the city, there were only two precincts that supported the measure. Both of them were in South Phoenix. They were both along the light rail line that's proposed for South Central to run from downtown, basically down to Broadway. And that is the area where this entire Prop 105 fight started. It was the genesis of the whole thing was discomfort in the neighborhood over this proposal that morphed into this plan to not just stop the one extension, but to stop every single extension going forward in the city. And so those neighbors were very clearly engaged on it and very clearly supported the idea of stopping light rail.
And it's interesting because another part of town, sort of west, like down by the state capitol, there's also a proposed line there, and voters there seem to support the idea of light rail and oppose Prop 105.
Right. In fact, there's two other proposed extensions. One of them would run from downtown to the state capitol and then down I-10 all the way down to about 79th Avenue. Voters all along that route were widely supportive of light rail. They rejected Prop 105 at a higher rate than most of the city did. Same thing with up near Metro Center. There's a planned extension to go from 19th and Dunlap over toward the Metro Center Mall area. Again, same thing we saw there, that voters in those areas were more supportive of light rail than the city as a whole.
Jim, what does turnout have to do with this? I mean, this is a special election that didn't happen in conjunction with much else. What kind of percentage of the overall population of voters are we talking about?
Yeah, turnout, it was a special election, so it was low. It was 26%, but with the caveat that 26% in a special election with nothing else on the ballot. With nothing else on the ballot, it was actually much higher than I think people had anticipated when the campaign started. I know folks we'd spoken with involved in the campaigns had anticipated it would be somewhere around 12, 15, maybe 17%, 6 months prior to the election. And so for that to end up at 26%, I think shows, that Phoenix voters were engaged in this issue. And that, I think that in particular, I think the pro light rail side, the side that was fighting against these campaigns, I think really did a good job of turning out their supporters and contacting the voters that they knew were going to care about light rail.
Jim, you guys also looked at sort of the partisan split of the city and the precincts and how they voted on light rail. What did you find there?
Yeah, it was an interesting little find there. Even though this thing lost very badly, there was a very strong correlation between precincts of the city that Doug Ducey won in his gubernatorial election compared to it. Precincts that he lost. And in the precincts that he won, very strong, the more he won a district, the better Prop 105 did. And the more people voted to end light rail. And so I think you can very clearly draw a connection between Republican voters and the effort to stop the light rail.
Okay, final question for you in the minute or so we have left. Is there a lesson here, you think, for future campaigns like this that are sort of trying to get a vote on an issue that is very specific and city-oriented and on a special election?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough, right? Because light rail is something that's really visible that people see and people interact with in a lot of different ways, whether they're drivers or whether they're actual commuters that use it. But I think that the idea that light rail has had a big benefit on the city, I think, is one that is a selling point that has really won over a lot of voters. You know, for other campaigns going forward, I think it's a matter of how do you crystallize that, the idea, whatever the issue is that you're fighting for or fighting against, how do you really crystallize that and communicate it to the voters and then go out and make sure that you're targeting the right voters to get to turn out. And I think it's very clear from the results we saw here that the opponents of Prop 105 believe that people who live near light rail and use light rail would support it, and it looks like they were right.
All right, that's Jim Small with the Arizona Mirror. Jim, good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
A grand jury indicted a Phoenix woman after being accused of forging signatures in a series of high-profile medical marijuana zoning cases. Alexia Nunez faces 10 counts of felony forgery and one count of fraudulent schemes, but after she skipped her arraignment last week, there is now a warrant out for her arrest. The criminal charges come more than a year after Jessica Boehm of the Arizona Republic first published an investigation looking into a series of questionable patterns in medical marijuana cases that came before the Phoenix Board of Adjustment. I sat down with Boehm after the news of the indictment came down to learn more about it.
So Alexia Nunez is a canvasser. She had at one point told the city council that she owned a business that collects signatures. And this is kind of why she got in trouble, because some of those signatures that she was collecting for cases in Phoenix, the attorney general's office found to be forgeries. Mm. And so that is why she ended up indicted.
And this all has to do with medical marijuana dispensaries and the zoning for those. So let's get some background here. This is because of a story you broke about a year ago.
Yeah, it's been a while, but back last year, there were a series of medical marijuana zoning cases that came before the Phoenix Board of Adjustment. And all of a sudden, even though these marijuana dispensaries aren't near to one another, the same individuals started getting involved in opposing them. Hmm. And so a number of attorneys kind of came forward and said, hey, is this one maybe a competitor who's trying to kill all these dispensaries so they can capture a part of the market? And so at that point, I started looking into all these similarities and trying to nail down why are these similar people involved? And one of those similar people was Alexia Nunez, who was indicted earlier this summer.
But she's not alone in this. Who are the other players here?
So there are other people that were appearing multiple times in these cases, including two pretty prominent lobbyists, Joe Villasenor and Layla Ressler, both of whom have large connections to multiple council members. Now, worth noting, they were not involved in this indictment, but they were involved in previous cases and worked with Alexia Nunez. And so we're kind of at a point where it's unclear whether there are other indictments forthcoming or if this is just about the forgeries that Alexia turned into the city.
Sure. Give us a sense of how medical marijuana zoning cases play out. Like, they can be really contentious because it's difficult to get zoning for a medical marijuana dispensary, right?
Absolutely. So the reason these are so controversial and the reason they kind of breed this kind of almost hostility in these cases is that it is really hard to find a place left in Phoenix where you can zone a medical marijuana dispensary because there are really strict rules about where they can go. So usually you have to get an exception to say, can I get a little bit closer to a park or can I be a little bit closer to a school? And so usually those cases have to come before a hearing officer and the Board of Adjustment. And that gives a lot of opportunity for this kind of controversy to arise because there are so many different rules about medical marijuana.
So what were the results of Nunez's alleged actions here, these forged signatures? How did they play out?
So they were able to, in most of the cases that she turned those signatures in or was working for in some way, those cases actually went the way that she was hoping that they would. And so that obviously drew ire from the attorneys on the other side, which is kind of what prompted people to start looking into this. It's what eventually led to people finding these similarities and having some questions about what this could mean.
So what could happen now that she's been charged with a felony?
So she did not show up to her arraignment last week. So she now has another warrant out for her arrest. And so when she is arrested, at that point, she will have a significant bail. And so she could end up staying in jail until her court date. So at this point, I guess we will see what happens on that front.
That is Jessica Baim with the Arizona Republic. Jessica, thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much.
In less than a month, thousands of Arizonans who've not been paying their utility bills are going to have to start up again. In June, regulators imposed a temporary moratorium on electricity shutoffs after news of a Sun City West woman who died after having her power turned off because she owed $51 to APS. That moratorium ends on October 15th. In testimony before the Corporation Commission earlier this month, APS officials said as of September 3rd, 86,000 accounts were more than 30 days late in paying their bills, and that customers combined owed around $23 million. In a typical summer, they said that number would be closer to $9 to $10 million. So what will happen in a few weeks when customers will have to start paying their power bills again? With me to talk about that is Cynthia Zwick, Executive Director of the group Wildfire. And Cynthia, what have you been hearing about the effect the moratorium has been having on customers paying their bills?
Well, what we know is from the agencies that serve families that need assistance that nothing has slowed down. So there's a continual request for assistance that is being maintained. It's continuing. What we're seeing from a utility perspective in conversations and filings that we've seen is that the number of people who are taking advantage of the disconnect moratorium to pay other expenses is climbing, and the level of the bills that are being owed is also climbing. So we're seeing balances beginning to build fairly significantly.
Do either of those surprise you?
No. We actually, Wildfire filed a letter with the Corporation Commission when this was being considered, asking them to take into consideration the length of time of this disconnect moratorium, because we knew people would take advantage in a positive way of the need to pay additional expenses or cover other costs while this was happening. And so what we know is people who are living in a vulnerable situation, who are living at the poverty level, for example, have a difficult time at any point in time paying their utility bills and feeding their families and covering costs for medicine. So what we knew would happen and what we expected would happen is during this period of time, they would use the ability to sort of take advantage of an opportunity that presents itself to pay those other bills. And so they're letting slide perhaps some of the utility bills that they know they have to pay and they will take steps to pay. But those bills are climbing now.
Well, so what happens now between now and the middle of next month when those utility bills do come due and people are going to have to pay maybe a bigger lump sum or a bigger minimum payment because they haven't been paying over the summer?
Right. So what we've seen happen in the past is people will show up at agencies with bills that are in excess of $1,500, so between $1,500 and $2,000. At the end of the moratorium, they're likely going to be placed on a four-month payment plan, which will essentially divide up that bill and then apply it to next month's bill. So we know they're not going to be able to afford it. So what we're really encouraging people to do is reach out to their utility now. If they're eligible and not currently enrolled in the discount program, they should get enrolled in that program. They should also ask for payment plans now to begin paying on their bills and make whatever payments they can. At the same time, they should reach out to the organizations throughout the state that help people pay those bills and start to lower the bills that they currently have.
Is there a concern that with this moratorium that some of the problems that lower-income Arizonans face in terms of paying utilities and paying for everything else, that those problems are just kind of getting kicked down the road a few months and that come mid-October, they're going to have the same problems that they had in May and June, just it's a little cooler out?
Yeah, so the bills are still going to be unaffordable, which they have been typically. And so those bills are going to be now larger and larger, and people are going to be less and less able to pay them. So that we're working with utility companies to extend the time frame within which people can pay those bills back. but it's going to be a huge issue. I think the other thing that we know is going to happen that we're not really talking about is there's going to be a strain on other parts of the system. So people are going to need more help with food. People are going to need more help paying medical bills. People are going to need more help paying their rent. So I think the whole system is going to be strained when the moratorium ends. And I think the other thing, you know, there is assistance available, but the assistance that's available is inadequate to serve everybody who's going to be in need. So that's why it's so important to get in touch with utility companies now and begin to work out a way to pay those bills back.
When you talk about strains on other parts of the system, is that because people are going to have to be paying more for their utilities because they haven't been paying over the last few months?
Exactly. So if somebody's been paying or has a bill that's sort of in the summer runs around $200, $250, and they haven't been paying for 4 months, and then that amount of money, whatever that aggregate looks like, is divided by four and then added to their next bill, it's just going to be an insurmountable amount of money to pay. And so they're going to need, if they're paying on that bill, they're also going to now be looking to food banks for support for food, to other organizations for support with rent. The downside of this is if they can't continue to pay their utilities, many of them will be evicted from their homes. And that would be a horrible outcome as a result of this moratorium.
Are you anticipating that there will be more disconnections coming up in October or November as folks can't pay their bills?
What we're really concerned about is around the holidays, people will see a lot of disconnects. And so most of the customers will be placed on a four-month bill payment unless they can get inside and start negotiating a longer-term payment, which places them about December, January for disconnect, which would be a horrible time of year. So the concern is that, yes, there will be a huge number of people that would not normally have been set up for a disconnection process that will now be facing that after the first of the year.
Is there a better way to do this in terms of helping folks who can't afford their utility bills in the summer while not having them just sort of pile up and then having to divide them over a few months after the summer?
So there's a couple of things. I think a lot of it depends on the communication that utility companies have with their customers and the interaction that they have on an ongoing basis. I think the more contact that there is, the better off people are and the more consistently people pay. But I think the other thing is we need to also look at larger systemic solutions like wages. So I think it's a complicated solution. I think also some states have had some success with looking at kind of tiered rates or percentage of income rates for lower income families. So we're looking into some of those solutions as well. But right now we're in a difficult spot.
All right. That's Cynthia Zwick, Executive Director of the group Wildfire. Cynthia, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Now we're going to check in with the editorial board of the Arizona Republic. It's a weekly segment where we talk about current issues facing the state and the nation, featured in columns on the newspaper's op-ed pages. Following 9/11 in 2001, a child psychologist was commissioned to research how New York City kids in public school were affected by the terrorist attacks. And what she found led her to deep conclusions about the achievement gap in America. Phil Boas, editorial director of the Arizona Republic, wrote a column about Pamela Cantor and her findings. He spoke with our co-host Steve Goldstein for his weekly appearance and began with why he wanted to tell Cantor's story.
This starts as a column about 9/11 and the aftermath of 9/11. And one of the things that surprised me in thinking about 9/11 last week with everybody else was the thing I wasn't thinking about. I wasn't thinking about radical Islam that much. I wasn't that worried about it, about the Islamic bomb and the madrasas and all of that, the things that we worried about, you know, so many years ago, 18 years ago. And I think part of it is because we became familiar with a part of the world we'd been so ignorant about, and we had to. We were just sort of jarred into a larger consciousness, and we wanted to learn why those people hated us and would do something like that, okay? Well, we understand it better today. And we're not as intimidated and threatened by it, although we know it's still a huge threat out there. But I think there are bigger threats out there. And I think the greater threat today, thinking back 18 years, the greater threat we face today is internal. It's domestic. It's among ourselves. It's the division that is emerging in American society and just ripping us apart. That keeps me up at night far more than radical Islam. And that's why I was thinking about this woman who has a 9/11 story that most people have not heard.
So Pamela Cantor is someone who We need to get her background, first of all. She did some research and found amazing things about what low-income kids, kids in poverty in certain areas of New York, for them, 9/11 seemed far away because of what they were struggling with every day.
Right. So Pamela Cantor in 2001 is a clinical psychologist who has a 9/11 story that most people have not heard, most of our audience hasn't heard. In the weeks after 9/11, the New York City School Board came to her and asked her to lead a team to look at the impact of 9/11 on New York public school children. Were they traumatized by this event? So she and her team went looking for trauma in the public schools there and around, you know, Ground Zero. And they found a lot of trauma, but it virtually had nothing to do with 9/11. It was the trauma that came from growing up in poverty and dealing with all the dysfunction that comes with that and dealing with neighborhoods that are poor and where there's violence and drugs and where there are broken families and things like that. And she went further and they studied the issue and looked at it and found that that trauma, that poverty was actually having an impact on the brain that was physically affecting the brains of children and affecting the learning centers of the brain. So it was harder for them to acquire knowledge. It was stunting their growth as students.
Mm-hmm. There's such a separation now between people who have educational opportunities, maybe by virtue of their color, but maybe just based on how much money they have. That's really causing the exacerbation of this, right?
Right. So what Pamela Cantor was working on, the problem has a name. It's called the achievement gap. And it is this great gulf between students who grow up in poverty and who are inordinately minority students, but a large group of white students as well, you know, millions of white students as well across the country, growing up in poverty and do not have access to the same kind of education as, say, the child of two lawyers in North Scottsdale. You know, they're dealing with a lot more problems in those schools, especially in the urban centers. They're dealing with all kinds of what, you know, what she pointed out was trauma. And that sets back their learning. It denies them access to the economy that enriches us all. And it is a huge problem that has held for 50 years. The achievement gap has lasted at least 50 years, longer than that. And you have this great gulf in scores between those children who grow up poor and children who have more things in their lives and parents who are devoted to their education.
What can be done about it as a society? Because we tend to look to our politicians. What can we as communities do and politicians do to actually make a commitment to trying to close this?
So the reason I've been thinking about it is because the thing that worries me more than radical Islam is these internal divisions in America. And if we're going to overcome them, one of the best ways to overcome division is to get working together on a problem. And we have a huge one in this country, and that is the achievement gap. I'm making largely a conservative argument that conservatives need to care about this issue because more and more we're going to have to defend the free market system, free enterprise. It's coming under assault. And one of the reasons it's under assault is because this country has not lived up to its promise of providing equal opportunity to all young people so they at least have access to a good education and the promise of entering this economy.
That is Arizona Republic editorial director Phil Boas talking with our co-host, Steve Goldstein. Good Monday morning to you. You are listening to the show here on KJZZ. I'm Lauren Gilger along with Mark Brody. Coming up later this hour, I sit down with some of the Valley's restaurant scene's biggest players who also happen to be musicians. But first, we turn to the border. The number of people arrested and detained at the U.S.-Mexico border dropped substantially in August. U.S. Customs and Border Protection detained 64,000 people at the border that month. 3 months earlier, arrests peaked in 2019 with 144,000 border crossers detained in May. So why the big drop? Mark Morgan, interim director of Customs and Border Protection, credits Mexico's deployment of military forces to its borders and the Trump administration's policy changes.
The president has made it very clear that he's going to use every tool available to him and this administration to address this unprecedented crisis at the southern border.
Morgan says Mexico has detained 134,000 undocumented immigrants so far this year. That's 50,000 more than all of 2018. Lisa Magana is a professor in the School of Transborder Studies at Arizona State University, and she says all of this can only be understood in context.
First, let me emphasize that apprehensions have been going down significantly for the last 10 years for a variety of different reasons. There's always fluctuation during particular months, especially when it's really hot. So we know that migration definitely goes down when the weather is much hotter. And so not surprisingly, you know, it's going to be a little bit lower in August and September, but this is not surprising. But again, these numbers have consistently gone down. And we need to think about what is that in terms of immigration policies. What is it when we talk about, oh, these have been deterrents or these have been working? That's not necessarily the case here.
Hmm. So when you say the numbers have been going down for a decade, that might surprise a lot of people, right? Because of all of the talk that we hear about a crisis on the border and, you know, thousands of people waiting to come into the country. This is a little bit of a different population, maybe.
Absolutely. So when you talk about apprehension data, we tend to think about Mexican and unauthorized immigration crossing the border. And that has absolutely gone down in the last 10 years, partly starting after the recession. We know that's gone down. You've heard this idea of net migration, people that have left the U.S. and people that have not, that are not coming from Mexico. And in fact, if we think about apprehension data and or the undocumented population, Mexicans are no longer the majority. Now the majority are those from Central America and Asia. And so this idea, presumably, that these Mexicans are crossing the border and being apprehended really is not a good indication of effective immigration policy. And if I could just say, apprehension data is kind of a, it's actually really a bad way to measure how effective a policy is. So you can say, well, maybe 300,000 people were not deterred by these enforcement policies. So look how many people are able to circumvent these policies. Hmm. Or you can say, oh, what a great job. You picked up this many people, you apprehended. We've also seen that could be an indication of just more or better record keeping. Hmm. You know, not necessarily has anything really to do with the flow of migration. It has much more to do with what's going on in terms of activities or being able to assess.
And so when you're talking about that refugee sort of population, those people seeking asylum, mm-hmm. right, this might point to this other statistic that came out recently. The number of migrants deemed inadmissible at the border actually rose, about 3,000 people from July to August. Is that a different can of worms, essentially?
That is a different can of worms in that these are likely Central Americans that are applying for refugee status. And as you may know, right now, the Supreme Court and the courts are ruling as to whether or not, and it's not even clear, it's so new, that this decision of whether or not you can apply for refugee status if you're in another country or do you have to be at a point of entry, it's just not clear. And mm-hmm. so these people are being turned away because, quite frankly, we don't know what we're supposed to be doing right now.
The policies have been changed.
The policies are changing weekly. I'd say this week, daily.
So finally, let's talk about another immigration-related story this week. Reports that the Trump administration may again cut the number of refugees allowed in the country. The president has already cut that limit. It was a cap of 110,000 the last year of the Obama presidency. It's a 30,000 this year. What effect, first of all, has that had, just that decrease?
Well, first of all, this is really problematic. The nature, the spirit of refugee law is to be able to accept people that are fleeing well-founded fear of persecution, people whose lives are in danger. So a good example would be we just had the terrible hurricanes in the Bahamas. With a particular limit, we're going to tell people that have an absolute right to claim refugee status that they can't because there's a certain limit. And so this can have a very devastating impact. And I would say that looking at refugees as a way to control undocumented or unauthorized immigration is disingenuous because, again, these numbers have gone down significantly. It's the same argument for why we need this wall. It's out of control. We're in a crisis mode when, in fact, the reality is it continues to go down.
There is some talk that the Trump administration could lower this number even to zero. Has that ever happened in the history of this country?
I have not heard anything. We start refugee laws around 1940s during World War II. But no, I've never heard anything. The laws were separated from regular immigration and separated into refugee, but nothing like this. And the other thing, it's not only national, it's international, right? This idea of looking at hotspots or crisis areas that, again, as part of being a world player, we are to accept and help refugees, who, again, whose lives are in danger.
That's Lisa Magana, a professor in the School of Transborder Studies at Arizona State University. Lisa, thank you for coming in.
It's my pleasure.
Israeli voters head back to the polls tomorrow to decide whether or not to give Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu another term. It'll be the second election in the past few months in that country and is one of the key international stories in the coming days. And joining me for our weekly look at some of them is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones. And Rob, remind us why exactly voters in Israel are casting ballots less than 6 months since the last time they did so?
Well, Mark, as you know, Israeli politics are complex with plenty of different parties, policies and personalities, the three Ps. At the center of it all, the man Benjamin Netanyahu, who has overtaken David Ben-Gurion to be Israel's longest-serving prime minister. And this election, like the previous one, is essentially a referendum on him. Now, in the last election in April, the party of Mr. Netanyahu won the most seats, but it did not win a majority, and that meant he needed to make a coalition of smaller parties to stay in office. He couldn't do that in the time he was allotted by the law, so this week they're going to the polls again.
So what has been at stake in this campaign?
Well, quite a bit, as Mr. Netanyahu has promised, if he wins, to annex a third of the West Bank. That's the territory occupied by Israel where most of the inhabitants are Palestinians, but it's not legally a part of Israel. There are settlements of Israeli Jews who live in the territory. These settlements are considered illegal under international law, but of course Israel denies that judgment. We should add that Mr. Netanyahu has said similar things before. Perhaps he won't keep his promise if he wins. Perhaps he will. This election will be close, and he needs Israeli right-wingers to vote for him, hence maybe this inducement. Now, if you look at things from the Palestinian point of view, well, they hope that any future peace deal between them and Israel will result in an actual state of Palestine, the so-called two-state solution. So they're reacting angrily to this pledge, saying it's the end of peace talks if Mr. Netanyahu's plan goes ahead. Israel, of course, is a strong country, but it has this streak of insecurity, understandable given the history of the state and its people. Mr. Netanyahu plays on this to some extent. His campaign has majored on Israel's enemies in Iran, Syria, and Lebanon. His message, repeated time after time, is that the Middle East is a tough neighborhood, and he is the only politician who can keep Israelis safe. Election posters also show him with President Donald Trump, both men smiling, suggesting a unique partnership that only Mr. Netanyahu can maintain. And of course, Israel under Netanyahu has received a lot from Washington in the last couple of years. And Mr. Netanyahu is facing several counts of corruption. Analysts say he's hoping for a majority that will help protect him from indictment. His main rival, I should finish on, is a center-left coalition called Blue and White, led by a retired general, Benny Gantz. And General Gantz says he can restore honor to the premiership. So he says that's his role, if you like, in the kind of post-Netanyahu world.
All right. So Israel is going to the polls tomorrow on Thursday, Rob. A decision in Japan over the nuclear power plant at Fukushima. What's going on there?
Yes. So now your listeners will remember that in March 2011, there was a major earthquake off the coast of Japan. That caused a massive tsunami which came ashore, killing many people and disabling the power supply and cooling of three reactors at Fukushima on the east coast of Japan, facing the North Pacific Ocean. Now, Japan has been struggling ever since with who's responsible for this disaster. Earlier, prosecutors decided not to bring charges against the state power company called TEPCO. But this week, the court will decide if the executives of the company are liable for the disaster. So that's what this week is about.
And Rob, the cleanup for that accident is still taking place. And there's even been talk of running out of space to store the radioactive material. Is that right?
Yes, with such a large area affected, it's been an absolutely massive project to clean up this space. Take a listen to our correspondent here in Japan, Rupert Wingfield Hayes, who's been talking about that effort.
But the really big difference between, for example, what happened in Ukraine with the Chernobyl disaster and what's happened here in Japan at Fukushima is that the Japanese government has decided that this area has to be cleaned and has to be restored. And it is a vast, vast operation that will take many decades to complete. But all of the material that is being cleaned up, all of the topsoil that's being removed, it has to be taken somewhere, and it is being brought here, and it is going to be buried. And the quantities are just mind-boggling. 14 million tons of waste material has been created so far. That all has to be buried underground.
And that's Rupert Wingfield-Hayes, our reporter in Japan. One of the main issues, I should say, Mark, has been the water they've been using to clean the site, which itself has some radioactive material in it. Last week, a Japanese government official said they were running out of storage capacity for that water and that eventually it will have to be released into the Pacific. The government in Japan later retracted that statement, saying it was just one person's opinion. But you can see, you know, how messy and how convoluted that whole process is.
Yeah, messy, exactly. All right, so Rob, finally on Sunday, an international day to get us thinking about how we get around. What's that about?
Yes, well, on Sunday, it's World Car Free Day, an attempt by environmental campaigners to get cities around the world to promote alternative transportation, especially for short trips. So cities here in England, of course, we are only a small island, for instance, will be closing roads to highlight the effort. And London, where I'm sitting now, will have numerous events out on the streets on Sunday. It's taking place this year on a Sunday, which is convenient because it won't disrupt normal workday commuting. But in years past, there have been some major unintended consequences to car-free days, such as in Madrid, Spain, which experienced massive traffic jams on roads that weren't closed when it happened there. There's also a belief that the more campaigners advertise car-free days, the more people will think that it's actually a good day to drive, i.e. nothing on the roads, meaning that traffic actually in some places, ironically, could get worse on Sunday instead of better.
All right, that's the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones. Rob, as always, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Phoenix musicians are behind some of the most popular bars and restaurants in town. Lauren Cusimano, food editor for the Phoenix New Times, first reported on this trend in a piece she dubbed Demos to Dining. And she joined us at Gracie's Tax Bar alongside two of the story's subjects to talk more about it. Grace Perry is the bar's owner, formerly of metal band Landmine Marathon. And Wayne Coates runs Instrumental Hospitality Group, which is opening a restaurant in Phoenix in the spring. Lauren has always been a fan of the local music scene, and she said her writing about music was a way to go deeper into the community. And that way, she became intimately aware of the changes coming to the Phoenix food and drink world as she recognized the names of some of her favorite musicians opening up some of the hottest spots in town. So what does take someone from, say, the death metal scene to the world of dining? For Grace Perry, the transition just made sense.
Well, it was a long journey because I was in punk bands and more into that world, and punk evolved into hardcore and hardcore evolved into metal. And then I ended up in a death metal band for 7 years. And during that time, I had graduated from NAU and didn't use my degree at all because I was completely dedicated to touring and trying to make that work. And around age of 26, I realized that I kind of wanted to actually use my degree that I had spent so much time and money earning. And I looked around with no, you know, essentially like 9-to-5 job experience, but I had a ton of food and restaurant experience, and I had been working at Upward Projects, as we all know, Postino, that whole group, and they were going to open Federal Pizza. And I rose my hand and I said, do you guys want a manager? And thankfully I had a pretty decent head on my shoulders after all the touring withdrawals. And they gave me an opportunity, and I went from there into Windsor and Churn across the street, and then heard of an opportunity at Crescent Ballroom. And I tossed my name into the hat, landed a gig as food and beverage director, and then went on to be the food and beverage director for both Crescent Ballroom and Valley Bar. So after that, it was one of the best jobs I ever had. I learned so much in such a quick period of time, and that is about the time that I was decided to get married. And I, again, kind of looked up and and realized that, you know, maybe I do want a little bit more of a not 4 in the morning job, not running around at all, you know, all weekends and all holidays. And so I got a job in the nonprofit world. Then after I got married, we had a chunk of change and realized that I did not want to sit in front of a desk, you know, which just seems a little all over the place. And I know, kind of crazy, but I went to my husband and I was like, hey, instead of buying a house, this money, you want to buy a bar? And now 2 years later, here I am with an amazing place for the neighborhood that I'm super proud to have. And yeah, it's kind of been a wild ride.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Okay, and Wayne, let's turn to you. So a similar story for you that you ended up in the restaurant beverage world for those kinds of reasons? Were you working in it all along?
Most of my professional life was restaurants. I started out at Sonic at 15 and kind of carried on to starting my own restaurant group this summer, opening Belly, our first spot in the Melrose District, sometime in the spring. I had been in multiple bands growing up, did a lot of touring in my early 20s, and like Grace mentioned in the Phoenix New Times article, it was easy to come back being broke, getting off tour, and picking up some serving gigs or some bartending gigs, and that flexibility has always been much appreciated, to be able to kind of have that. And, you know, over that time, I certainly fell in love with restaurants. I think the energy of the space is really important. It's about, you know, connecting and sharing food together and always really just pushing to for that feel good.
It sounds like what you're saying is like it's not all that different from what you would do when you performed a show, like creating that kind of community.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities between organizing shows and organizing services at restaurants. I think a lot of the energy is very similar to being in bands. You know, everyone kind of having their part, cueing the rhythm section, bring in the guitar solo, you know, very similar to round of beers, fire dinner. You know, really the timing and the rhythm is so similar. And growing up working in restaurants, it was often musicians that were working alongside me.
So Lauren, as you're putting this together and profiling quite a few people like this who are in this world now and making this sort of leap, what kind of similarities did you see? Were there some like through lines that were true for everybody and some reasons you really think this works?
Honestly, I started out having no idea what the hell was going on. And that's why I kind of set down this path, you know, like I covered Thunderbird opening and Jeremiah told me about Dana Armstrong, the gal who still runs Valley Fever, opening Dirty Drummer, and I started noticing this trend, and it was just happening like once a month this new place was opening up from musicians. So I honestly didn't really see what could have been happening until honestly it was like Wayne, it was our interview where Wayne drew so many parallels between being in the food and drink industry and being in a band, and like how they just went on this overseas trip. He said felt a lot like tour. And even something Wayne said is what led us to titling the story From Demos to Dining, because he was like, people used to give me demos to check out, you know, back in our 20s, and now people are giving him dishes to check out. So it was kind of like, and Wayne was my final interview for the piece, so it was kind of like this really fantastic, I don't know, wrap-up sesh kind of on what really is happening and how the migration is so easy. It seems like this natural progression of people who were in bands and are used to just kind of like setting their own hours, being their own boss maybe. Mm-hmm. And now they're able to run this business and successful businesses because, you know, these people are artists and these people are creative. So they create creative spaces. That was a lot of the word creative, but yeah. It's, you know, it works and it appeals to an alternative crowd because these people are alternative people themselves.
Yeah. Is this like the grown up version of the music industry then in town?
That's what I was wondering. That's what I was wondering. Cause a lot of people are like, you know, music is fun. And a lot of us, a lot of this group still do it on the side, but it's kind of like, you know, you either make it or you don't, you kind of grow out of it. And then turns out a lot of these people ended up being fantastic business owners.
Yeah, I think the, you know, a lot of similarities between wanting to express yourself, writing songs, making records, going on tour is very similar to the restaurant food and beverage industry in town. It's really a way to kind of set up a camp and, you know, kind of make a mark on your hometown, whereas touring is so much getting out into the world. And you know, setting up shop is a great way to still be able to express yourself creatively and work with your friends and involve the community and really inspire people and give them a sense of kind of an escape from all the crazy things in the world and a time to kick back and feel good and feel
like you're part of something.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Outside of the creativity, the work ethic and passion, because it's not easy being in a band. It's really, really hard. You have to have a very insane work ethic to make it even at the bare minimum of being able to pay some of your bills through music. And so the restaurant industry is the same way with work ethic and passion. Like, you have to have a blinding love and devotion towards it in order to make it work. I mean, it's the most failed industry that there is. Mm-hmm. And so I think that mentality of like never giving up and pushing your mental and physical limits to the max is something that not a lot of people carry with them. And I feel like musicians do.
Yeah. Yeah. High risk, high reward industries both, right?
Yeah.
So the last thing I want to talk about, you kind of mentioned there, Wayne, is this idea that this is about building community, like anchoring yourself in a place. And one thing I noticed, Lauren, in the article is that so many, I think everybody in it is from Phoenix, like grew up here, right? And you talk about this idea that what they maybe are trying to do is preserve that culture, not build a new one, but cement it. How do you feel about that, Wayne?
Certainly the leaders in the food and beverage scene in Phoenix have found that collaboration and community is really the best way to grow their space and their teams and their outreach. I think that's inspired all of us so much, you know, growing up knowing Grace for 20 years or so and hearing about the things she's doing and talking with her about those things and then being inspired myself and then vice versa, sharing news. I think there's, you know, a lot of energy within the community and a lot of inspiration that has rubbed off on others, and to be able to share that with each other and grow together over decades is something very special.
Yeah, there's a lot of love between all of us. I mean, when you name, we knew every single person in that article, you know, like, and we're all a bunch of nerds. We all just love each other and a bunch of nerds. We're not out to like be in competition with each other or bring each other down. Like, you know, you talk to every single one of us and we're going to build each other up in a really positive and loving way because of those decades of history and support.
Yeah. So do you think that what you're trying to do here, or do you think that maybe just an offshoot result of what you're doing here as a community of musicians and now restaurateurs or whatever is helping to sort of define this culture in Phoenix that is sometimes hard to define?
I will say that there was a piece of the story that my editor kind of drug out of me, which was admitting, which I didn't want to, that a lot of us used to talk about moving away. You know, if you wanted to be a journalist or a musician, you were thinking LA, you were thinking New York, you were thinking the Northwest. And a lot of us kind of didn't, like, we probably all traveled quite a bit. I mean, you too, quite a bit. But we all ended up sticking around, and now I'm just so grateful that none of us moved away. And that was kind of my final thought on the piece, was we got these people who, we're so lucky to have people like Charlie and Chucky who just like developed these spaces, made it so fun, I just think it created like a real sense of pride. And now I get very defensive if someone puts down Phoenix. It's that old, you know, saying, if you're bored, you're boring, because there's so many fantastic things to do here now.
There's definitely a small, very small town community within this giant metropolitan area. And like Lauren's saying, you know, sometimes people are, hey, Phoenix isn't cool, whatever. But I always think they haven't found the right pocket or the right group of people or the cool spots to hang out that provide this sense of community. And I think as it's growing, it's really exciting as we're becoming, Phoenix is becoming a big city. And it's great to be part of that.
I mean, just as a Phoenician, like, I absolutely agree with Lauren that, like, we all talked about moving away. We all talked about the bigger and better in other cities, and I'm not going to disclude myself from that. But after, in the past probably 10 years, I've lived downtown for 10 years now. And yeah, and so just seeing that transition, I couldn't have more Phoenix pride in me than I could imagine, as far as, you know, knowing that Phoenix has the potential and the amount of people that are moving here every single day. And I think all of us really just wanting to show that to the, like, not just, you know, the city itself, but to this country of, like, you know, we're a really cool city that you can come and you can do cool things at, not just Austin, Texas, not just Portland, Oregon, not, you know, not those places that everyone always escapes to.
Yeah. All right. That's Grace Perry, Wayne Coates, Lauren Cusimano. Thank you so much.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.